I certainly thought someone had found his quietus, with someone's else Bebodkin, but a match being struck and a candle lighted, the medium was found sitting quietly in his chair, with his bonds undisturbed, and no sign of perspiration on his skin. The floor, however, was littered with musical instruments and bells, and the swords of the unseen combatants were lying along with them. The scene sketched by the artist in two of the cuts give an idea of the appearance of the room, before the extinction of the candle and upon its relighting. The medium, or rather the spirit controlling him, for he is supposed to be in an unconscious state, and his organs used by a spirit, which may or may not be true, and which I do not regard as important in the settlement of our problem, then invited me to take measures to satisfy myself that the phenomena were genuine. Accordingly, a gentleman present, Mr. George W. Nichols, of John H. Draper & Co., Auctioneers, New York City, sat in Horatio Eddy's lap, while I, drawing up my chair in front of him, placed my feet upon Horatio's toes and held Mr. Nichols' hands, thus making it impossible that either of the three should move without each of the others knowing it. Moreover, Horatio could not move if he wished, for his hands were tightly bound to the back of his chair, and even if he could disengage them, he could not move them forward to touch us, or the instruments scattered about. His slightest motion would be instantly detected by the man sitting on his lap. The light was again extinguished and a new performance began. Hands, cold, clammy, and firm, stroked our faces, patted our heads and hands, slapped me on my back and legs, and Mr. Nichols on the parts of his person not leaning against the medium. A pair of lips kissed my cheek, and two huge hands tickled me under my arms at one time. Then the accordion, concertina, and tambourine were played all about us, bells were rung, blows given on the floor with the swords, and the guitar, floating through the air or resting upon my head, played one or more familiar airs. Meanwhile, every person in the front row of the audience sat with hands joined, which is the same as saying that no one, even if so disposed, could get to us to do what was done. These manifestations being concluded, light was called for, and we too resumed our seats in the circle. The artist's sketch shows our relative positions during the test sitting. The next thing in order was the improvisation of rhymes by Mayflower. The dear child, who came and laid her little hand on mine for an instant, allowed me to name the subject, and then reeled off a score of limping hexameters, hardly worth preservation as specimens of poetry, even if I could have had them reported verbatim. But when she breathed the words through the stops of the harmonicon, with exquisite modulation of the sounds, her golden stairs and silver shores and heavenly fields seemed almost to come before us as pictures of a fairy land. Then George Dix's voice announced that the band, composed of spirits known as Electa, Honto, Santum, Rosa, the Italian girl, French Mary, Mayflower, and himself, would render the piece called The Storm at Sea. I would have the reader observe that I regard the names given to themselves by the various spirits as a matter of the smallest possible account. I doubt very much if Santum or either of the other names are of genuine Indian origin, but that does not trouble me as much as to know if any spirit from the other world is standing in my presence. That is the question of questions. Individual identities are of trivial importance in comparison with that. I am no musical critic, and so will give place to a competent hand to describe this remarkable performance, which is given in a majority of Horatio's dark circles. Here is what Mr. Lenzberg says, and anyone who has attended a circle at Chittenden need not be informed of the difference between this sort of music and what Horatio favors us with. Henry S. Saltcourt, Esquire. Dear Sir, at your request I state the following facts. I am a musician by profession, and teach the art in Hartford, CT. I attended a dark circle at the Eddy House, last evening, at which various solos, duos, trios, and concerted pieces were played by some mysterious performers. The solos were upon the violin, guitar, flute, piccolo, concertina, and mouth harmonicon. The two most surprising features of the performance were, 1. The playing on a guitar as it floated from one side of the room to the other, through the air, a distance of at least 15 feet. This was not a mere strumming of the strings, but a delicate and artistic playing of a popular air in Pianissimo, and, to the execution of the air of Home, Sweet Home on the concertina. The invisible performer managed to get more power, and at the same time preserve as good expression as any person I have ever heard handle the instrument. I noticed the same striking feature as with the guitar playing, viz., that the musical sound was prolonged, and the swells maintained, through a much greater space laterally, than any mortal performer could cover, and at the same time sustain the same quality of tone. There were no sounds of footsteps, and the instrument was played so close to us that I could feel the wind it made as it passed through the air. I have heard Horatio Eddy, the medium of the Dark Circle, play on the violin, and I unhesitatingly say that his style and execution are as totally different from those of the unseen soloist as possible. The concerted pieces were an imitation of A Storm at Sea, by the violin, with the accompaniment of the mouth harm on a gon, tambourine, concertina, triangle, guitar, and several bells. In The Storm, the whistling of the wind was made apparently by bowing on the guitar with one hand, and at the same time by sliding the other up and down a fingerboard, producing harmonic notes. The heavy blowing of the gale was imitated by a tremolo on the violin, accompanied by a confusion of sounds from the other instruments. The shock of waves against the ship was forcibly suggested by lifting a heavy table and beating the floor with its legs. There was one sound that could not possibly be imitated by any instrument, viz., the pumping of water, with the suck of the piston, the gurgle of water in the tube, and its splash, as if running off on deck. Throughout the whole entertainment, the medium sat in a chair in front of the spectators, with his wrists tied together and to the back of the chair. A light was struck instantly after some of the most remarkable performances, and he was found in the same position and tied in the same manner as at the first. The front row of spectators kept hands joined from first to last. There was but one member of his family present beside himself, who sat next but one to me, and I am positively sure that she had nothing to do with what occurred. Even if she and Horatio had been on the floor, it would have been impossible for both together to do what was done. The above is as careful and minute an account of the musical part of last night's Dark Circle as I can give, and I am ready at any time to substantiate its truth by my oath in a court of justice, if called upon. I must tell you of one thing that happened, as wonderful as anything above related. My little daughter, sitting at the other end of the front row, asked the child spirit calling herself Mayflower, to kiss me, and immediately I received kisses upon my mouth and cheek from a pair of smooth, soft lips, which certainly were not Horatio's, for he wears a heavy moustache and goatee. Moreover, the room was so totally dark that no human being could have found the places touched, without feeling for them with his hands, which was not done. Max Lenznug, 20 Pleasant Street, Hartford, Connecticut, Chittenden, October 14, 1874. This is a dark circle as it appears to persons favored with only the usual range of senses, a place of pitchy darkness, unlimited by the faintest speck of light, except when little balls of phosphorescence shoot hither and thither through the air, the only senses ordinarily used being those of hearing and feeling. 218. But how different must it appear to the inner sight of the clairvoyant, if we admit that their descriptions are not based upon the promptings of an overwrought imagination. I was so fortunate as to meet at the Edison Mrs. Emma F. McCormick, an excellent test medium, of Providence, R. L., who kindly gave me a description of the dark circle that I will try to put into words, as, at least to me, an interesting novelty in spiritual literature. When the light was extinguished, instead of the cavernous darkness that oppressed our senses, the room became to the clairvoyant suffused with a great light, as though a full moon had suddenly risen upon her vision. The light was steady, not flickering. The walls of the apartment, as transparent as crystal, disclosed a multitude of spirits stretching upward and backward, a great host that no man could number. On every side they thronged men, women, and children, and gazed at the mortals below and the scene that was being enacted in their hearing. They were all bathed in the light that shone about them, but differed in glory, one from the other. Certain of them hovered over and about the medium, showering sparks of light upon him more brilliant than diamonds, whenever they approached him within a certain distance. From every side in the air above us, the light, concentrated into a sort of zodiacal canopy, formed a vortex, like a water spout or thundercloud, and then spread out in showers of sparks, whose radius marked the area within which all the manifestations occurred. Some spirits were clothed in gauzy vapors of differing brightness and colors, some bluish, some grayish, and some pure white, the several tints indicating the moral status of the spirits, pure white being the highest of all. Their countenances shone with a brightness corresponding with that of their raiment, some like the face of Moses when he descended from Sinai, being so glorious that it seemed as if no mortal man could look upon them. Upon the floor of the circle room the lurid saw a spirit man with a smooth face, stern and resolute in expression, who controlled and directed the performance. When he approached, the rest fell back, as though he carried the power of command in the very essence of his nature. The Indians in the dance were sometimes on the floor, sometimes leaping high up in the air, and one group, apart from the others, laid their heads together and intently regarded some object on the platform, which, from Mrs. McCormick's description of the locality, I judged to be a small spring table gong that I had procured that day, with which to try certain experiments that I shall describe at the proper time, but of my possession of which she was not aware. Off in one corner were gathered a band of white men whom she thought were pirates, who had stealthily approached, and looked at the medium as if desirous of getting control of him, but a number of bright spirits, seeing their intention, clustered about him as if to shield him from harm. The color of the light around these pirates was a dark drab, and when the body fell after the sword combat, previously described, she seemed to see a dead body carried off by these comrades, who were enveloped in a dense cloud of smoke. Mayflower appeared a girl of 14 or 15, of a fair complexion, dark hair and eyes. She looked as if she were encompassed with a rainbow, and was a bright, beautiful creature, but more attracted to the earth than some of the others in the shining throng. The effect of her music upon the other spirits was very marked. They seemed to enjoy it, and their feelings were indicated by a great increase in the brilliancy of the light about them. The members of our circle of the evening were each attended by his or her special friends, who showed affection in embraces, loving appeals, the laying of crowns of flowers upon our heads, and of emblematic floral devices of various kinds upon our laps. Some seemed to her to kneel at the knees of their friends, and gaze up into their faces with eager, hungry looks, as if they would force a sense of their presence through the impenetrable walls of flesh in which they were still held captive. We mortals, like our spirit friends, were also surrounded by our special and peculiar spheres of light, varying in brilliancy, color, and transparency, in degree with our moral elevation. Along the united hands of the front rank ran a chain of electricity or some other fluid, like lightning, reddish-yellow in color, with bubbles of light coming up here and there, and then bursting, and the even flow of the stream interfered with and made to zigzag by the unequal personal magnetic force of the several sitters. In the storm at sea she saw Dix holding what seemed a bunch of reeds, that vibrated as a stream of electricity or other bright fluid ran through them. When he imitated the pumping of water, it seemed as if he forced two masses of electricity together, handling the subtle agent as if it were a solid substance. She could see him stretching out his hands and gathering it from the air to condense and compact it, as one might gather light snow and form the feathery flakes into a solid ball. He was never idle, but passed from one employment to another with indomitable perseverance, now playing the violin, and anon imitating the whistling of wind or the swash of water, according as the exigencies of the performance seemed to demand. But, of a sudden, the beatific vision of the clairvoyant is rudely terminated by the lighting of the smoky candle, whose feeble gleam, struggling through the obscurity of the room, replaces the noonday brightness of her opened heavens. Chapter 15, Philosophical Tests. Among other tests that I desired to apply to Honto, was one to satisfy myself whether she possessed the superhuman power of self-levitation. I accordingly procured a small table gong, which could be rung by dropping a weight of half an ounce upon the handle from the height of 1 inch, and took it to Chittenden with me. One evening, when a favorable opportunity offered, I requested the spirit to step upon the handle without ringing the gong, which I had previously placed on the platform at a convenient point for observation. She assented, but before trusting herself upon the frail knob examined it with characteristic caution and curiosity. She finally gathered up her skirts, and, placing the ball of her right foot upon it, stepped up and bore her whole weight upon it without disturbing the clapper. The experiment was repeated twice at my request. I then asked her to step on it and cause the bell to ring after she stood fairly upon the knob. She did so. Her success seemed to amuse her greatly, and by clapping her hands and in other ways, she testified her satisfaction. She advanced her hand towards the unfamiliar object with the caution that one would feel in laying hold of something hot, but finally mustered courage to take it up and ring it over and over again, laughing and dancing like a child pleased with a new toy. Her usual performance with the shawls and gauzes then followed, and she strutted up and down the platform with a long piece of the latter material wrapped around her, as though she were a belle promenading in a new mantilla for the public admiration. Just before she was about to bid us adieu, I asked her to place the gong on the railing directly in front of me and ring it, so that I might distinctly see her hand pressing down the knob. She bowed compliance, and putting the article where I designated, retired for a moment into the cabinet, perhaps to gain strength, and then returning, lifted her skirt again, rang the bell with her left foot, and ran out, kissing her hand to us. The wire to which the knob of the gong is attached, is about as thick as a broom straw, and I regarded the experiment as of great importance, until I afterwards found that, by stepping very cautiously, and bearing on very gradually, I could make the knob sustain my own weight. But I could not ring the bell after I stood upon the knob, nor step on it as briskly as she did, without causing it to sound. She was dressed, this evening, in a new white costume throughout. My reference to her retiring into the cabinet for the purpose of gaining renewed strength from her medium, recalls to mind an account I saw in the London Spiritualist, some time ago, of an experience of Sir Charles Isham, Bart, with a famous materialized spirit called Florence, who appears in the presence of Miss Showers, the medium. Sir Charles was accompanied to the house of Mrs. MacDougall Gregory by a lady, whose description of what occurred he quotes in preface to what he has to tell himself. Says the Lady Florence, who had seemed very willing to receive all the other members of the circle, exclaimed in a distressed and startled tone when I advanced toe and leer, "Not so near, not so near," and then, as if in pain, she added, "There is something comes from her that hurts me, I feel melting away, I must go back to my medium, to get more power from my medium." These last sentences were uttered in very feeble, faltering tones, and her appearance gave the impression of one who was fainting away, or sinking away. The face was ghastly pale, and the eyes turned upwards so that the white only was visible. She withdrew behind the curtain, and I returned to my seat, but in a few moments she reappeared, and I was shortly afterward recalled. Mr. Gregory gave me a rose to present to the spirit. This time I was allowed to come nearer, but my presence still seemed to excite alarm and distress, the spirit again exclaiming, "Not too near, not too near." She accepted the rose, however, without hesitation, her long attenuated fingers slowly and feebly closing round the stalk, as though she had very little muscular power. She then said, in a very languid, plaintive tone, "I must go now. I must go now." It was the same in London with Mr. Crook's real Katie King, who had to retire into the cabinet from time to time to gather strength. 10 spirits appeared this evening. Honto, Mrs. Pritchard, an aged lady, who spoke to her son and to us all in whispered tones, Miss Maggie Brown, who brought out her bouquet of flowers, as usual, Mary Staples and Clarinda Tilden, whose brother was present at this, his second séance, Carolyn, who held a baby in her arms, and at my request, shifted it from her left arm, where it was badly seen against the dark background of the curtain, to the right, where it was well relieved against the white wall, DeWitt Hitchcock, a young man with black moustache, Clara Arnold, a child of 4 years, whose father instantly recognized her, and Jonathan Morse, an old man and former neighbor of the Eds, who addressed us in a heavy bass voice. One of Horatio's light circles followed, at which the gentleman and lady whose portraits were given in the illustration to a former chapter, sat beside the medium. The usual manifestations occurred, hands of various sizes being distinctly and often shown in various places, several instruments played upon simultaneously, and the heads and backs of the sitters, including the medium, patted and stroked by the detached hands. Let the reader refer to the picture above alluded to, which is drawn to a scale, and accurately shows the respective distances of the sitters from each other, and from the various points about them, and he will see the impossibility of Horatio's stroking his own face and patting his own head, with his right hand thrust through the opening between the two shawls, without immediately betraying himself by pulling the shawl behind him off the cord that sustains it. I have recently had a letter from Mr. C. O. Poole, a wealthy gentleman residing at Metuchen, N.J., about what he saw at one of these light circles, in company with myself and about 30 other persons. I make the following extracts. I saw three hands appear at once that night. You undoubtedly have it all in your notebook, and I need only say, that I am ready, and willing to certify, and even swear to the facts. Among other things, I saw the guitar rise above the curtain, at least 3 feet above Horatio's head, and saw a hand on it apparently strumming the strings. This, of course, was not the medium's, for it would have been a physical impossibility for it to have been there. The usual writing of the names of deceased friends of the spectators by spirit hands, upon cards behind and in front of the curtain, was varied upon this occasion for my particular benefit. A number of blank cards were called for, and handed by me to one of the spirit hands thrust through the curtain to receive them. The pen and inkstand were then passed through in like manner, and immediately a number of cards came showering upon me, over the top of the curtain at a point between the gentleman and lady sitters, and, as it appeared to me, not from the direction they would start from if thrown over by Horatio's liberated right hand behind the curtain. The cards were all blank when I handed them in, and no other cards were on the table at the beginning of the séance. Moreover, each of those thrown at me had something written upon it, and the ink was so fresh that I laid them out separately upon the railing to dry. What was written may be seen by a glance at facsimiles numbers R6. I expressed my satisfaction at the favor shown me, and said, that the facsimiles I would give would no doubt be very interesting to the public, whereupon there was a general ringing of bells, strumming of instruments, and pounding upon the table, that gave a sufficiently marked response to my friendly speech. The next day, when the artist and I compared the cards with the width of a newspaper column, I thought it would be better to have the names written perpendicularly and on a narrower strip. So, without saying anything to Horatio, I laid a piece of thick paper on top of a cupboard attached to the wall of his bedroom, in the hope that the ever-watchful invisibles, knowing my wish, would favor me with a corrected edition of their signs manual. The next morning I found the paper covered with signatures, headed with some lines of wretched Latin, and topped off with some equally bad English. I give a facsimile of this remarkable document, which may possess a certain interest in the eyes of many, as probably the first thing of the kind that has appeared in a newspaper. I am quite aware of the fact that, as a scientific experiment, the procuring of the second set of names has no value, for no one was present when it was written, or can affirm it was not by the medium himself, so I let that pass. But what shall be said of the cards, written in the light circle before 20 people, which bear so marked a resemblance to them? That Horatio could write them with his right hand behind a thick curtain where he could not see the marks his pen was making? That he could draw a flying bird, a sketch of a house with its rear extension and detached woodshed? That he could ornament names, written piecemeal and not with a continuous pressure of the pen upon the paper, with wreaths? This theory will hardly cover the probabilities. Immediately upon seeing this series of facsimiles reproduced in the graphic, which was not for several weeks after the originals were written, and after they had been forwarded to New York, I noticed the striking similarity in the shape of the letters with Horatio Eddy's own manuscript. Public attention was also called to the same fact by a correspondent of the paper. The circumstance is well calculated to excite suspicion of fraud on the part of the medium, and I must regard it as weighing against him. But it is far from conclusive proof of his turpitude, for, strange as the assertion may seem, I have it from credible authority that communications have been written in exact facsimile of a medium's handwriting, in his or her presence, when the writing was not done by the medium. One lady of high social position, and not a public medium, informs me that on one occasion, when she was sitting with her sister, alone, a communication was written by an invisible power, upon a sheet of paper held by her against the underside of the table top. The writing so resembled her own that she would have been willing to swear that it was written by her own hand, if it had been shown her under any other circumstances. The next evening found Honto in a very lively mood. She seemed to overflow with animal spirits, running up and down the platform, dancing, kicking up her feet, and producing her shawls from all sorts of unexpected places. Her hair tonight hung loose down her back and was unusually thick. I have previously, I believe, stated that it varies from time to time, not only in the style in which it is worn, but also in its length and mass. This evening its great length and thickness were remarked by a lady spectator, whereupon Honto turned her back towards us, and leaning back, let her luxuriant dresses hang over the platform railing. I should judge that the hair was a yard and a quarter in length, and it was as black as jet. She shook her head to straighten it out, and then with a sudden movement threw the whole mass over her face and held her head down so that it covered her face and bust like a thick crepe veil. The way she flung it about proved to one even as inexperienced as myself that it was no wig, for it would have been jerked off her head. There being a number of newcomers in the hall, she stood beside Mr. Pritchard to show her height and backed up against Mrs. Cleveland for the same purpose. Finally, the light being good, she planted herself against my height scale, and Mr. Pritchard laying his cane across the top of her head, we saw that he called the figures, 5 feet 3 inches correctly. The squaw Bright Star and a number of other spirits also suffered themselves to be measured, the figures being as follows: name, height. Honto, 5 feet 3 inches. Bright Star, 5 feet 2 1/2 inches. Swift Cloud, feet 5 inches. Samtum, 6 feet 2 3 4 inch. Beakwa, 5 feet 3 1 2 inch. Carrie Arnold, 4 feet. William Brown, 6 feet 1 inch. An old white man, 5 feet 7 inches. On the following evening I tried an experiment that I think is unprecedented in the history of scientific inquiry. It occurred to me, that if the assertion of the spirits that in materializing themselves they accreted matter from the atmosphere by the operation of their own will were true, and that the relative solidity of their materialization is under their control, the thing might be tested by familiar mechanical appliances. I could not conceive of solid matter without weight, and I had had too many proofs of the materiality of the visible spirit forms to fancy them imponderable and unsubstantial. I had not only heard the shock of Honto's feet upon the floor when she leapt over the railing and when she jumped high from the floor in some of her capering, but, both in the dark and light circles, had shaken hands with them, and been touched and playfully struck many times. To my sense of touch they appeared as substantial as any human being in the flesh, the only difference being in their temperature, which was invariably lower than my own, and the skin, which was ordinarily covered with a clammy sweat. To put my theory to the proof, I procured in Rutland one of Howe's standard platform scales, the capacity and accuracy of which are attested in the following certificate. Rutland, V.T., October 6, 1874. Henry S. Saltcourt, Esquire. Dear Sir, I hereby certify that the platform scale you procured from me for your weighing experiments was one of Howe's best standards, set true and in perfect order. It will weigh from 1 ounce to 500 pounds. Its own dead weight is 110 pounds. Respectfully, I. G. Kingsley. I caused it to be placed upon the platform, to the right of the cabinet door, and just in front of the chair in which Mr. Pritchard sits. Being denied the privilege of sitting there myself, in consequence, as I am told, of my being of so positive a nature as to affect and repel the spirits, in which particular neither Mr. Pritchard nor Mrs. Cleveland resemble me at all, I had to rely for my experiment upon the gentleman in question. Accordingly, I rehearsed the operation with him thoroughly, until he was able, in the dark, to quickly weigh a person stepping upon the platform and stopping there but a moment.